I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 10th. The time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator French, Senator Bishop. I expect Senator Machicki will be joining us shortly, as well as Senator Fairclough. Senator McGuire is excused today, and I myself, of course, am here. Senator Giesel. Supporting staff today, Recording Secretary Ann Kreckelberg. Helping us out on the recording is Claire Gross. So thanks very much, and my trusty staff, Lindsay Williams. Senator Machicki has just joined the committee. Let the record reflect that. So today we're going to continue the consideration of Senate Bill 138, the gas pipeline bill. So today we're hearing from Black and Veatch, and I'm kind of a sequential person, and I realized that I lost one of the sequences. Actually, talking to Black and Veatch should have been very much at the beginning, because you, that company, did the work that advised the administration and the departments on how to proceed. And so what we're going to hear from today is that basic underlying information. I am very thankful that the slides are only number 73, because the presentation in November was like 180 slides. So thank you for shortening it. Presenting today for Black and Veatch, we have Jason DeStichter. He's the senior consultant and I guess you do the modeling and so forth, right, Jason? Online, we also have Deepa Poduval and Peter Apt. So they're online in Houston. I guess they're lifelines for you, Jason. So that's great. Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner Mike Pawlowski from the Department of Revenue, will also be here with us. So welcome, Jason. If you would introduce yourself for the committee for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jason DeStichter. My colleague Deepa was supposed to be here, but for family emergencies, she could not come up, and so she's on the line with us. I will actually let them introduce themselves first on the phone.
That sounds great. Deepa, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. Welcome.
Okay, thank you so much. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Deepa Poduval. I'm principal at Black and Veatch, and I'm joined here in Houston by my colleague Peter Apt, who's the managing director at Black and Veatch. First, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to present before this committee today. We're looking forward to an informative as well as an engaging discussion with you. I'd like to introduce myself, and then we'll have Peter and Jason share a little information on their background as well, before we jump into the meat of the presentation itself. I've been working in the energy industry with a specific focus on natural gas for the last 13 years or so. I started my career at Lucas Energy Group, which was acquired by Black and Veatch in 2005. And just as a bit of a background, Black and Veatch is a privately held corporation. We have about 10,000 employees spread over 100 offices worldwide. We specialize in critical human infrastructure, which means we're focused on three verticals: energy, water, and telecommunications. We also have a fairly large division that supports the federal government. My colleagues and I presenting today are part of the management consulting division within Black and Veatch, and I'm happy to say we have a long history working with the state of Alaska. Lucas, as well as Black and Veatch, have supported the state of Alaska in its North Slope gas monetization effort starting during SGDA and through AGEA and now through the Alaska LNG project. During this time, we've had a highly qualified and a varied team of professionals, including PhD economists, engineers, regulatory experts, natural gas pipeline industry experts, LNG market experts, as part of the team that has supported the state over the years. I myself have been part of and have led the team supporting the state for the last 8 years, focused on economic analysis, markets, and commercial support. My background, I have a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering and a master's in economics from Vitsipilani in India, and a master's in engineering management from Dartmouth. In one way or the other, I've been involved in examining the Alaska project closely for years through the many variations it has taken. And I will be leading the presentation today with the help of my colleagues. As Jason mentioned, I apologize for not presenting before you in person. An unexpected family medical situation forced me to cancel my travel plans last night. With that, I'll call on Peter to introduce himself, and then, Peter, if you would have Jason go next, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Deepa. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Apt, and I am a managing director here at Black & Veatch, responsible for our oil and gas fuels practice. I've been with Black & Veatch for about 7 or 8 months or so. Immediately prior to that, I spent about 10 years working for Gazprom, assisting them in the development of their global LNG strategy, focusing on commercial structures, negotiating commercial agreements, terminal use agreements, sales and purchase agreements of LNG. So I have a deep background in LNG and LNG markets. I've been in the oil and gas industry for over 30 years. I have a petroleum engineering degree, a Bachelor of Petroleum Engineering from the University of Oklahoma, and a Master's in Business Administration from the University of Houston. I spent time working in the oil and gas or in the oil and gas development exploration production field, drilling and completing wells. Spent time in pipeline development, mostly on the commercial side, and then have also run trading organizations. So I have a deep knowledge of the U.S. natural gas business, the global LNG business, and the issues that we're facing as we try to develop the Alaska LNG project. Jason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Jason DeStichter with Black & Veatch. I'm a senior consultant within the Management Consulting Division. I've been working on this project with Deepa since 2008, deeply involved with the modeling effort, the ins and outs. If you like spreadsheets, you would like my job. If you don't, you would you would hate yourself. Most of my client engagements focus around economic analysis, financial analysis, risk analysis. I have special expertise in that area. My educational background is in mechanical engineering. I have a Bachelor of Science. Additionally, I went another year, fifth year, and got a business administration degree with an emphasis in finance. And additionally, I just received my professional engineering license this time last year. And with that, Deepa, I'll give it over to you.
Deepa, before you begin, I just want to also acknowledge that Commissioner Balash is on the phone listening in. So I wanted to have his name on the record. So go ahead, Deepa. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to slide three, well, this one's the most important slide in our entire presentation. It's also where we test your vision. It's our standard disclaimer statement, so I'll move on to slide four, please. Before we delve into the North Slope royalty study itself, I wanted to note a couple of facts here on the slide. First is that the study was undertaken between June and November of last year, and hence it preceded the finalization of both the heads of agreement as well as the memorandum of understanding that were executed in December and of last year and January of this year. And while the study informed the state administration as it negotiated those agreements, the study as well as this presentation here that summarizes it, you know, do not analyze the specific terms in those agreements or their impacts on the competitiveness of the Alaska LNG project. We did, as part of the study, point out, you know, several factors that were taken into consideration by the administration and addressed where possible within those agreements, factors like the risks associated with going with royalty in kind, the concerns with procuring access and control in a potentially integrated LNG project, et cetera. After our summary of the royalty study itself, we've also included in this presentation deck some supplemental analysis that summarizes some ongoing work that look at specific terms in the MOU and HOA and their impacts on the state. We look forward in the upcoming weeks to presenting some of that analysis and working with the legislative consultants to pull together analysis that would be related to the specific decisions at hand. I also want to mention that in the interest of time, we've summarized the royalty study here at a high level in this presentation. There's a lot of work that was done that is not included, including various detailed analysis. For GRINS, we counted the number of model runs that went into the analysis that was included in the royalty study, and there were more than 100 separate scenarios that we looked at. Before and since then, we've analyzed various issues at the request of the state and continue to do so. So there's a significant body of work that the administration has looked at, that we've produced in getting to this point. Going to slide 5, the executive summary. I'm going to touch on these at a high level because there are several slides here that lay out the background, the findings, as well as the conclusions. And the reason I'm doing that is just to give us an overview of the study's highlights, but not slow us down here initially because we will be touching upon almost everything that's in the executive summary here, through the body of this presentation itself. If there's, at any point a question or someplace we need to slow down and discuss, we're more than happy to do that. Slide 5, just as background on the study, the project itself is an LNG project that's proposed to liquefy North Slope gas and export it, primarily targeted to Asian markets. We think of the project as being comprised of three main components, the GTP, the pipeline, and the LNG plant itself. The capital cost baseline estimate that we're working with is $45 billion, and it falls within a range of about $37 to $39 to about $54 billion at a high level for the project components itself. I know you're familiar with the public estimates of $45 to $65 billion associated with the project, and just for reference, that number would include the investments on the upstream, especially at Point Thompson, that would be associated with the project. And so when we're talking about a range of $39 to $54 billion, we're specifically focused on those three project components that are listed here. The gas for the project, as you're familiar, is expected to come from Prudhoe as well as Point Thompson, and that is our assumption within the study. And the main sponsors on the producer side are Exxon, Conoco, and BP. And at the time of the study, we anticipated potential participation by TC as well as the state of Alaska. From a timing perspective, the FID, or the final investment decision for the project, we assumed would be around 2017 to 2018, with the project achieving commercial operation around 2024. So that's just to, establish a common baseline on what some of the big picture assumptions were as we looked at the project. The study had two main objectives as we looked at it. The first was to provide information that can help the state protect its royalty interest in the state's gas and to maximize the state's value from this project. And the second objective was to understand what the state can do to incentivize and impact the success of the Alaska LNG project in its role as the principal landowner of the oil and gas resources on the slope. And so with those dual objectives of protecting the state's interests and incentivizing a project, those were the glasses through which we were examining the project itself. The team that worked on the study included us, Black & Veatch, as well as Daniel Johnston, who provided his international fiscal expertise, It was conducted under the leadership of DNR with support and consultation from DOR as well. In addition, inputs as well as assumptions that were provided by the project sponsors, the producers, were considered as well. On slide 8, we wanted to highlight here that, you know, and this will become apparent to you as we walk through the presentation and the study itself, but there's a lot of uncertainty related to this project at this point. It is a significantly large project with many complex variables that simply cannot be perfectly foreseen at this point. So given that, we try to make, you know, best assumptions possible as we've run through the analysis. Wherever possible, we attempted to be conservative in the assumptions that we've chosen. And we want to recognize, you know, that there's various ways and many reasonable scenarios that can be created to look at this project. And they will undoubtedly lead us to you know, several conclusions. as such, what we're presenting here is our view of the market and how we see this project, and it does not necessarily represent, you know, the official view of the administration. I'm almost wondering whether we skip.
Deepa, one second. I just want the record to reflect that Senator Fairclough has joined us. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I apologize for we're just consulting here. What I'm going to do is skip past the key findings because we're going to hit upon all of those points in the summary of each of the scope items here very shortly. And I want to take us to slide 15, which lays out the conclusions of the study, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
That would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. The bottom line of the study was that it's our assessment that the Alaska LNG project can be economically feasible and competitive with some changes to the project's cost structure and the state's fiscal framework. From an incentive perspective, we can have fiscal as well as non-fiscal incentives that can assist a project such as this and improve its commercial attractiveness. Fiscal incentives would be a reduction in government take, either royalty or taxes, and ways to share the cost of this project, which are expected to be significant. And there are some non-fiscal terms as well that can be very valuable in a project such as this, such as stabilization provisions and modifications to some lease terms. Specifically, you know, an example would be the state's right to switch between royalty in kind and royalty in value, and that has some implications for an LNG project that has long-term contractual obligations associated with it. We anticipate that the Alaska LNG project would be an integrated project, like several large LNG projects are worldwide, and highlighted that there are risks associated with integrated project ownership by the producers, particularly the risk of being misaligned, where project revenues could be shifted between the upstream and midstream in a way that could be disadvantageous to the state. And it's the producers fulfilling their fiduciary duties towards their stakeholders and trying to maximize their own revenues. On slide 16.
Excuse me, Deepa. Senator French had a question.
That seems like a key point to me. Hi, Deepa. This is Hollis French. Could you just spin out a little bit more about what might happen there, where project revenues could be moved between the upstream and the midstream components to maximize value to the producers? Could you just give me some examples of what you mean by that and why it would work to the producer's benefit and not to the state's benefit.
Sure. Hello, through the chair. Hello, Senator Hollis. Nice to be acquainted with you. We have a few slides within the presentation that lay out an example, but let me
then I can wait, Madam Chair.
Outline that example for you here.
Deepa, Senator French is willing to wait till you get to it in the presentation.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, then we'll.
But we'll remember the question.
Thanks.
Great.
Slide 16, one of the study's findings was that fiscal structure changes that are beyond just a royalty share or tax rate modification can help in improving this project's economics as well as in creating alignment. So in other words, rather than just reducing the royalty rate or reducing the tax rate, there are ways in which the state can transfer value to the producers while also getting value transferred back to the state. And direct participation by the state in the project in conjunction with establishing a gross share of the gas that would allow for an alignment of the share of the gas as well as a potential equity participation in the project could be an effective way to achieve that. Some of the other key benefits that we concluded direct state equity participation could have include, again, this alignment of interest, which you will be hearing more about, but also creating transparency through the midstream portion of the supply chain for the state entity that participates in the project. Having the ability to facilitate third-party access to the midstream and potentially increasing the state's cash flows as well as improving the producer economics. On slide 17, the establishing a gross share of gas in lieu of production tax and marrying that with equity investment in the project can be a very effective way of creating alignment for the project, as well as a way that allows the state to maximize the value of its resources. Again, as we get into the study, we'll present analysis as well as examples of how that can be achieved. That said, we want to note that, you know, this is not a strategy without risks. While the state has the ability to lessen the project as well as the producer's risk by coming to the table and taking a share of the project, it will need to weigh those opportunities carefully, and the devil really, you know, would be in the details of how the deal is structured. Risk mitigation as well as commercial agreements that would be part of this strategy would need to be designed carefully to define what rights the state has, what obligations the state would be under, as well as to manage the state's risk exposure and achieve the objectives that the state would have in entering into an arrangement like that. With that, if we don't have any questions on just the executive summary that we've highlighted, I will pass it on to Peter to walk us through the LNG markets as well as the supply chain elements of the scope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. I just thought before Peter jumped in, it was important to take a step back again for the public and remember that these conclusion and these issues, one of the ones that Deepa just mentioned was the commercial agreements, the access for third parties. This is a review of the royalty study that was, as she said, completed prior to the finalization of the heads-of agreement and the memorandum of understanding with TransCanada. So these were the things the administration was looking at as key concerns that have been identified, and you've seen in some of our previous discussions around the heads-of agreement how some of these risks that were identified were either managed or articulated as an area of concern that we will continue to work on. So I just wanted to remind members that this is the foundation that built the state's response in the discussions with the producer parties.
Thank you. So, Jason, are you next in presenting?
I believe we have Peter Apt with Black and Veatch.
Oh, Peter, pardon me, I wasn't on the line there. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, this is Peter Apt with Black and Veatch. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to talk about a couple of sections that we undertook in the study, the first of which is the LNG market section on slide 18. Slide 18 gives you kind of a brief overview of the scope of this section of the study, and we had three primary tasks that we focused on. One was to provide an overview of how LNG is traded and valued in the various markets that are available to the Alaska LNG project. Then undertake an analysis of the history and a forward-looking view of future global LNG pricing trends. And finally then, to provide some discussion around the supply and demand projections in the LNG market and the potential implications that that will have on the Alaska LNG project. So on to slide 19. Let's take a quick look at the factors that influence LNG demand and supply. On the demand side, the LNG market is highly concentrated. Seven countries account for about 70% of global demand. The Asia-Pacific region alone accounts for 70% of all global LNG that is traded. And the demand for LNG is growing rapidly in this region at a rate of about 8% per year. Like demand, LNG supply is also highly concentrated among eight exporting countries, providing about 85% of the global supply. Liquefaction facilities or trains are very expensive, and the projects are generally project financed based upon long-term sales and purchase agreements with LNG buyers. LNG specifications or gas quality vary by project and between buyers, with the Asian buyers generally preferring higher BTU gas. Long-term, which means 20 years or more, contracts dominate the market and are expected to continue to do so in the future. Unlike natural gas or crude oil, there's no liquid market to provide price markers for LNG. So the price structures of the sales and purchase agreements need to provide certainty over long term to support the cost of the projects and the underlying reserve developments that are necessary to provide the feed gas to the LNG terminals. And in the past, LNG contracts have typically been structured with an oil price linkage. On slide 20.
Excuse me, Peter, one second. There is a question from Senator Fairclough.
Peter, thank you. On your comment that oil and oil product price linkage has been standard since 1970, is that in an Asian market also?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, yes, that is clearly the price preference in the Asian market. That has been the price, the dominant price throughout the world. The Asian buyers since the 70s have been the predominant buyers of LNG, and there is no natural gas market per se in Asia, so everything has been linked to crude since that time. There's been recent developments with the development of the Gulf Coast, U.S. Gulf Coast export projects that are trying to de-link some LNG prices away from crude oil, but the majority of LNG that is bought and sold in today's market is still linked to oil index contracts.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so on to slide 20, as I just mentioned, the crude-linked contracts are still the predominant contract in the market today.
excluding the North American export terminals that are proposed for the Gulf Coast region. We did see a period between 2002 and 2006 where there were some lower price oil link contracts that were signed by the Chinese buyers and the Japanese buyers. But those were mostly due to the prevailing economic conditions at that time, and some of the pressures that the project developers were under to get project financing. Recall back in 2008, we had a severe recession in the world, and there were some projects that were financed at that time that entered into what would be considered now as out-of-the-market contracts. The recent emergence of Henry Hub-linked tolling agreements in the U.S. Gulf Coast has created an alternative price structure that the Asian buyers are now very interested in. These structures are based on Henry Hub linkage, and in current market conditions are lower than the oil link prices for delivery into the Asian markets. Buyers in Japan and Korea are aggressively seeking Henry Hub linked contracts at the current time, and they're holding back on traditional oil or entering into traditional oil contracts right now. We anticipate that condition that we're seeing will not last for much longer. There's a limited amount, in our view, of U.S. volume that will be exported from the Gulf Coast. So once those projects have been identified and final investment decisions have been taken, the Japanese and Korean buyers will likely be back in the market once again pursuing oil-linked contracts. In addition to...
Excuse me, Peter. Senator French had a question.
Hi, Peter. This again, Hollis French. And this seems like an area of potential risk for us because if it turns out that the Henry Hub model becomes more dominant over the next few years, we could lose out because they generally pay less than the oil linked contracts. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator French. The Henry Hub linked price contracts are targeting entering the marketplace in about the 2017 to 2020 timeframe. So as we get into the demand projections going forward, you'll see that there's a period there where we anticipate that these contracts will fill the demand, but there will be demand needs beyond what the Gulf Coast can provide in and of itself. The underlying assumption there is that we will have a limited amount of export volumes out of the U.S. Gulf Coast. In other words, there has been some 20-odd projects that have applied for approval to sell LNG sourced in the U.S. to non-free trade agreement countries, and we don't anticipate that all of those projects will either receive approval, nor do we anticipate that if they receive approval, that they will ultimately get constructed. So we think that there is a limited amount of volume from the U.S. Gulf Coast region that will be available to meet some of the demand that is growing in Asia.
Senator French, through the chair, if I could add to that for the record, this is Deepa Podova. One of the other factors that we think will come into play, too, is the desire of the Asian buyers to have diversification within their supply portfolio. And not get overly dependent on any one source for their LNG. There are concerns about being too heavily dependent on shale gas from the U.S. as well as passage through the Panama Canal to get Gulf Coast LNG over to Asian markets. And so we anticipate that projects like Alaska that, have a well-established resource base, a stable political environment, proximity, all of those factors would make a project like Alaska attractive to the Asian buyers, even outside of price considerations.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I asked a fairly simple question, and the question I asked was whether or not a Henry Hub pricing scheme would pay us less than a crude linked contract would, and neither of the two presenters answered my question.
Could you speak in a sentence or two, either Peter or Deepa, in answering that question?
Through the chair. Senator, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. It is possible that the Alaska project could be priced through a Henry Hub type pricing mechanism, but we would need to determine what that fixed price element of the contract would need to be in order to make the project economic. That has not been a part of this analysis that we have undertaken at this point in time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's in the analysis here. I don't know why neither analyst is willing to say on the record that LNG prices under Henry Hub link tolling agreements are less than oil link contract prices. That just seems to me to be self-evident. It's in their presentation. Maybe I'm not speaking clearly, but it just seemed to me that it's important to point out that if the world is moving towards more towards delinking from oil contracts, that we face a lot of risk in that area. It just seems plain. It's in the summary, and so I guess I'll let the point go by, but because it is in the summary.
I think what Deepa pointed out was we don't know what the transport costs will be through the expanded Suez Canal. She pointed that out. And, of course, the distance is much greater than between Alaska and Asia. So I think that was the point they were trying to get at, and that they had not, therefore, analyzed that scenario. But they could certainly think about it and respond a bit later. Senator Dyson, you had a question.
She had an answer, I think, of this.
Did you have a question?
I do.
Oh, okay. Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. We'll be happy to work back through the committee to Senator French's question. I think what Peter was trying to say is that the Henry Hub link contracts have a variable component, which is the Henry Hub price. And then there is a fixed component, which is for recovery of the cost of the infrastructure. And without knowing what that fixed component looks like, it's difficult to compare them. We saw some work, and actually I'd compliment the legislative consultants this summer for doing some real work in that Henry Hub comparison analysis looking backwards. So we'll work together and get some of that information back of why the contracts are actually different in the way they're structured.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These discussions are pretty esoteric, and we are not only struggling to understand it herself, but want to make some accommodation for folks who are listening in and watching. Top paragraph here on this page says that bullet two, or top paragraph, the second dash, most recent contracts have a 14 to 15% effective slope. I think that you're saying that if you were to graph this, this is the relationship between the two prices at whatever volume. And then when it says the relationship, the LNG, dollars per million cubic feet, to crude price in barrels, so that's not a BTU equivalent, correct?
Madam Chair, I defer that
chair.
To Peter.
Go ahead, Peter.
Senator Dyson. This is Peter Rapt. In direct reference to the slope, what we're talking about is the conversion that is used to convert the LNG price from a crude oil price to an LNG price. In Asia, is typically 14 to 15%. So in simple math, if a barrel of crude oil was $100, the equivalent LNG price on a dollar per MMBTU basis, correction to what's on the chart here, is $14 to $15.
Okay, so it is
per MMBTU. So $100 per barrel of oil equals $14 per MMBTU at a 14% slope, $15 per MMBTU at a 15% slope.
It is a BTU equivalent. It isn't just what the market is doing that can be rational or irrational.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Michiki, a question.
Just a quick comment to clarify. I believe the slide is incorrect. I believe MCF should be MMBTU.
That's right.
That's correct. If I may, through the chair to Senator French, just to address your specific question with respect to the Henry Hub pricing versus oil link pricing, in today's market, the Henry Hub price is at a level that is lower than the crude oil link price. So Gulf Coast projects today, if they were in service today, at Henry Hub prices today, would be lower than the oil link price today.
Good. Senator Michiki, another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it also safe to say if we plotted out those two relationships over the last 20 years and likely the next 30 years that they would be all over the place on value in comparison?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, yes, I think that's a fair statement. We've seen tremendous volatility in natural gas prices here in North America that would have suggested that the equivalent LNG price or the Henry Hub-based price versus crude oil would be very, very similar, in some instances even higher than what the prevailing crude oil-linked price would have been over the past 30 years.
Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if this presentation is uploaded for Alaskans to see at the Resource Committee. And so if that is the case, which I'm getting a nodding head, that we make sure that on slide 20 that we actually correct the MCF to the MBTU so that Alaskans that are logging on to grab the information have it correctly. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, or excuse me, Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate that from Senator Faircliff. I'd also point out for members of the public that the full study is available on the DNR Commissioner's website under the Priorities tab. And within that, there are also a series of webinars where the consultants are in a video link describing some of the issues that the committee is wrestling with. The members of the public can go to and watch to get more information.
Thank you, Mr. Pawlowski. They're very well done videos, by the way. I've watched them. Seeing no further questions, Peter, I'll let you continue in the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on the bottom of slide 20. Just wanted to point out that there are some non-price features that are typically negotiated into the long-term sales and purchase agreements as well. And these typically include duration of contracts, the nature of commitment, take-or-pay type provisions is what we're referring to there, delivery terms, your ability perhaps to pull the cargo and take it to a higher value market, or not take the cargo and allow the seller to take it to an alternative location, and then the LNG specifications that I mentioned earlier.
Excuse me.
So on slide
Excuse me again, Peter. Senator Dyson has a question.
Digesting what you just said, there's a there's a contract. The buyer can say, "I don't want to take this one," and the ship can go to another market that's higher. Did you say that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson. A lot of these provisions are negotiated depending upon the actual demand that a buyer may have at some point in time, or the flexibility that the seller would include in its ability to divert a cargo. So typically, if it is a transaction where the buyer has purchased the LNG at the terminal, so it would be an FOB or a CIF, so freight on board purchase, the buyer then would control the flexibility of the tanker on the open water. If they did not have sufficient demand to justify delivery into the target market, they then would have the ability to divert that cargo to an alternative market.
Okay, I got it. There was a point I missed there. Thank you.
All right, go ahead and proceed, Peter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on slide 21. Which is a summary of the several forecasts showing projected LNG demand growth over the course of the next almost 20 years. And as you can see, there's a wide range in the forecast for growth over the next 15 to 17 years, as depicted in these forecasts. For instance, the difference between the high demand and low demand case in 2020 is about 40 million tons per annum, which is just over 5 billion cubic feet per day. So there's a great deal of uncertainty in projected future demand for LNG. The demand forecast used by Black & Veatch in the development of this study and all of the economic analysis that Deepa had mentioned earlier is depicted in the light, on the light blue line, which is labeled the reference case. Our particular view is a little more aggressive in the early years of the forecast period, say through 2015, and then is a little bit more conservative from 2015 through 2030. The difference in our forecast that we've used as our reference case and the other forecasts that you see depicted here is due to factors that differ based on view of the markets. For example, the higher volume forecasts have a more aggressive demand growth forecast in Asia than what we have in our reference case. Also, we believe there's an overly aggressive forecast on demand for LNG in Europe than what we see. And we also expect that other agencies are forecasting a much higher penetration in transportation fuels for trucking and marine facilities than what we've included in our forecast. So those are the primary drivers that cause the variation in the forecast for LNG going forward, the forecast demand for LNG going forward. And again, our reference case for the purposes of our analysis is the line depicted in the light blue. So moving on to slide 22.
Excuse me, Peter. Senator Bishop has a comment.
So, Peter, that your analogy here on this on slide on page 21, and citing your reference case, then that goes back with your theme of our assumptions in this study were made in a conservative manner. Is that would that be an accurate statement?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, that is accurate.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Go ahead and proceed, Peter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 22. What we're trying to depict here in slide 22 is a view of the break-even price for the Alaska LNG project. And so what this slide does is depicts the buildup of costs that are necessary to construct this project. And I want you to pay particular note that the price for LNG has no bearing on the break-even price. Okay, so what this is a depiction of each of the cost components. Starting on the left, we have the upstream costs, the cost of the LNG plant, the cost of the GTP and the pipeline, shipping from the terminus of the LNG plant to the market in Asia, the state's take, the federal government's take. We assume the NPV for the producer is zero, and so we calculate a break-even price of about $12.30 per MMBTU. This break-even price takes into account the capital and operating costs of the midstream, and we assumed an 8.5% discount rate on the midstream. And want you to also point out that the state's take and the federal take represent the taxes that each agency collects throughout the entire supply chain. Once again, our $12.30 number is a conservative number, but I want to point out that there's some key factors that can cause this either to increase or decrease. factors that can drive the increase in break-even price include a lower ambient temperature at the LNG facility in and of itself, which would cause the throughput or the ability to generate LNG to fluctuate. We have assumed that there is a 3 million ton per annum advantage due to expected operating conditions at the LNG plant. If the temperature is lower, that could be higher. If the temperatures are higher, the throughput could be lower. Perhaps the biggest factor that could impact the break-even price, either up or down, is the projected change in the capital costs. As we're going to get into when we get to the supply chain discussion, there's a great deal of uncertainty around the capital costs for this project. And an increase in capital costs would obviously increase the break-even price. A decrease in capital costs or increase efficiencies through the labor markets would result in a decrease in the break-even price. And one other factor that really might influence the break-even price and reducing the break-even price is negotiating with the producers and having them accept lower returns than what they typically look for in their midstream investments. Again, we've assumed an 8.5%, 10% discount rate on this transaction. The producers typically would look for something perhaps a little bit higher than that. Moving on to slide 23.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Peter. Senator Machicki has a question.
Peter, could you clarify? I believe you just stated that a higher ambient temperature would provide an advantage, lower cost advantage in liquefaction.
No, a higher ambient temperature would reduce the economics and result in a higher break-even price. I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator. If I was not clear on that, I apologize. But it's a higher ambient temperature would result in less LNG being produced than what we've assumed in our analysis.
And if I may follow up.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
And what were you... That's just a general term. You weren't analyzing a particular ambient temperature range for liquefaction conditions. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, at this stage, that is correct. We haven't gotten into any of the detailed engineering that would optimize the design of the plant.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead, Peter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On to slide 23. With this break-even analysis, then what we did is we compared the Alaska LNG project to all of the other proposed LNG projects that have a projected in-service date after 2013, now 2014, and we developed a global supply curve as depicted here on this slide. The break-even price of the various projects is plotted on the vertical line. Each slice along the horizontal axis represents an individual LNG project that's currently under development. And the relative capacity of each of those projects is determined by the width of the respective line along the horizontal axis. The box that's shaded in purple, at least on my view, I hope it is also purple on the view that you have, represents the amount of new capacity necessary to meet our projected demand in 2025.
That doesn't make sense.
So what does this curve tell us? The Alaska LNG project, as currently configured in the current fiscal structure, is out of the money, is projected to be out of the money. Projects with lower break-even price than Alaska can provide about 340 million tons in new supply, which is more than what's required to meet the projected demand of 250 to 300 million tons in 2025. So the Alaska LNG project faces significant competition, as there are several other projects who are also competing to meet this demand. However, due to many factors, not all of the projects under development are going to be in service by 2025 or perhaps even after 2025, including many of those that are situated on the supply curve to the left of the Alaska LNG project. As I mentioned earlier, many of these projects include the U.S. Gulf Coast greenfield LNG projects that are still seeking export authorization and have yet to file for authorization from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to construct their facilities. So it's highly likely that many, if not all, of the greenfield projects in the U.S. Gulf Coast will not be constructed. In addition, several of the projects located to the left of the Alaska LNG projects are located in relatively unstable areas throughout the world. And so the likelihood of those projects getting developed for multiple reasons are also questioned.
Peter? Pause a moment. Senator French had a question.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. The y-axis says project break-even levels. What are the units of measurement on that axis? It's not. I can't tell from looking at it.
Through the chair, Senator, yes, that would be dollars per MMBTU, similar to the axis on slide 22.
So $1 per hash mark?
No, the hash marks are just representative levels. They're not meant to indicate any specific numerical value. This is a representative cost curve for all of the projects that are under development.
But the red bar for Alaska is still 12.3, so I can just kind of figure it out accordingly.
It's not an exact science, sir.
Well, but I mean... But the 12.3 figure carries over from slide 22 to 23. Is that right? The break-even point, you told us on slide 22 it was $12.30 per MMBTU, and that's still the same value used on the next slide. I have to assume that.
Through the chair. Senator, yes, that is correct for the State of Alaska project. We have evaluated all of the projects throughout the world, and their relative value is depicted on this curve, not the exact value. But the point here is that there are many projects that are at a break-even price less than the Alaska project that have the ability to meet the projected demand in the 2025 timeframe.
It's an excellent slide, and I think it makes a strong point. I just wanted to make sure I understood what the red bar indicated. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator French. Senator Dyson, question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, find this very interesting and valuable. As Asian countries, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan particularly, have talked to us about gas and oil, I've always had a sense that one of the things that makes us attractive that's subjective is something you've alluded to, and that's the political stability and so on. But I've also had the sense that we're one of the few countries in the world that could protect the supply routes of ships. And certainly there are several regions in the area, in the country, that are gas suppliers and gas customers for whom the security of that portion of the supply chain would be important. Am I off base?
Through the chair, Senator French, could you repeat the question, please? You were breaking up a little bit there.
Yeah, certainly, it's actually Senator Dyson, but I take that as a compliment. It seems to me that a factor for these countries that are very dependent on imported gas would be the capacity of the supplier to protect the midstream, i.e. the LNG that's on ships, particularly at choke points in the world's maritime trade. Do you have any sense of that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I apologize for misidentifying you previously. But in response to your question, yes, there is a great deal of concern over the choke points that exist in two of the primary waterways that are necessary to transport LNG from supply sources to the market, that being the Suez Canal, and the second one being will be the emergence of the Panama Canal as a waterway from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Japan and markets in the region. That is of particular importance to the buyers. There is a great deal of uncertainty as to how ships will be queued through the Panama Canal and whether or not there will be additional costs incurred upon the ships to jump to the front of the queue, if you will, in order to secure passage through the canal. So having supply sources that don't rely on those types of shipping logistics are particularly attractive to the buyers in Asia.
Yeah, thank you. If I may, I would have included the Horn of Africa and the Straits of Malacca, but thank you for your response.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Senator Machiki, did you have a question?
I do, Madam Chair. Just going back again to understand where we so if the what you've plotted on slide 23, projects more economic than Alaska can provide 340 million tons per annum new supply, more than required to meet global demand, and you look at that gap between where Alaska is and the your little purple box. If we go back to slide 22, what causes the outlier? Is it primarily the liquefaction plant costs or the upstream costs? Midstream.
Through the chair, Senator Malicki. It's a combination of the costs throughout the project. One of the disadvantages that the Alaska LNG project has vis-a-vis the majority of the projects that are under development are the costs associated with the pipeline and the GTP that are necessary to take the gas from the slope down to the LNG terminal. Typically, the LNG projects that are developed around the world don't have a large pipe component in their cost structure. There will be some treating required, but probably not to the magnitude of what we're seeing here on this particular project. There is one project under development today in Australia that does, the Gorgon project that's being developed by Chevron and several others, that does have a high GTP cost, but they don't have a high pipeline cost associated with that project. So there's a couple of factors working against the Alaska LNG project that not all other LNG projects have to wrestle with.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up, please, Senator Machiki.
So, Peter, I can draw a big circle around everything from shipping to producer present value, and the LNG plant upstream costs are going to be similar. It really is isolated to the sort of extreme cost of the pipeline, and that's sort of what created that gap, just for a simple answer.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, that's a big component of the gap that we're seeing here. That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Fairclough has a question also, Peter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I look at the different projects that you have graphed on slide 23, Alaska's being in the red, does that indicate the volume of gas or LNG that will be available to markets compared with the size of the other projects?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the width of the rectangle, so you'll notice that the Alaska project depicted in red is one of the wider rectangles on that graph. Is that what you're referring to?
That is.
Yes, that depicts that it is a large project that will have large volumes of LNG produced through that particular project relative to other projects that we have evaluated.
And so if I might then, Madam Chair. Peter, then when other markets are looking at Alaska, and you show in your purple rectangle demand, Alaska might be a prize because we can provide that gas for longer terms. Would that be an attribute to our project?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth. Typically, an LNG project will have about 20 to 25 years of producible reserves because that's what's necessary to make the economics work for just about every LNG project. There are some that some projects today that are near the end of their productive life, but they've been producing LNG for 20 to 25 years. So it's very, very common in this business to have long-lived reserves that are supporting an LNG project. So the reserve position in Alaska clearly helps the project, but I'm not sure that it gives it a significant competitive advantage over other projects that are also competing to serve the markets in Asia.
Thank you.
Very good. Peter, if you'd continue. I don't see any other questions at the moment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to move on to slide 24. And slide 24 addresses, I think, some of the underlying questions that we've already talked about. And what we're trying to project here are the various factors that can influence the price that the Alaska LNG project might be able to obtain for the LNG produced. Factors that would drive a higher price environment, for example, would include the North American projects, particularly the Gulf Coast projects that we referenced earlier, being permitted at a very slow pace, a pace perhaps what we're seeing now or even slower. If that were to occur, then the non-North America conventional supplies, which we're talking about Australia and those projects in Africa and Russia, would then compete to serve the remaining demand, Alaska being one of those projects. Another factor that could drive favorable pricing for Alaska obviously would be for Asian demand to grow much more rapidly than what we've depicted in our reference case. Were all of this to occur, the very high-cost projects in Australia and Russia would become the marginal supplies, and Alaska is positioned very favorably relative to those projects in our view. And if we don't have an abundance of U.S. Gulf Coast source supply, sellers would be in a strong position where we could continue to demand the high-slope oil-linked contract terms as opposed to having to sell under Henry Hub pricing. We would anticipate in that type of environment that LNG would sell for somewhere between $14 and $18 per MMBTU. Under the low price scenario, North American LNG supply would be unconstrained. All of the projects that are currently proposed get developed. They're all competing for markets in Asia. The low-cost, non-North America conventional supplies would have to compete directly with those projects, and in many cases would be unfavorable and uneconomic. And under this situation, Henry Hub link prices become the price setter for all Asian LNG into the future. So that would be a downside scenario, obviously. The price that you would expect to see in the market would be in the $10 to $14 per MMBTU range. So in both scenarios, there's an opportunity for Alaska to compete, but obviously in the higher price scenario, higher demand scenario, there's a much better opportunity for the Alaska LNG to compete.
Peter, Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, thank you. What is the decline rate for non-conventional gas fields in North America? I assume it's not anywhere near as dramatic a decline rate as it is on the oil wells.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the decline rate for the non-conventional wells is very significant in the early years of production, and then it stabilizes over time. The underlying assumption for the unconventional is that we will continue to drill those wells. There's a tremendous inventory of prospects that will get drilled over time if the price signals are sufficient to justify the drilling. We've seen an increased improvement in the rig efficiency, if you will, so we can drill more wells with fewer rigs in fewer days' time. So in spite of a declining rig count, we're able to maintain current levels of production. The expectation is that U.S. gas supply in the lower 48 will be able to meet all of the projected demand going forward. And in fact, if the price signal is strong enough, we can bring additional sources of supply, even unconventional, on stream to meet that demand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Go ahead and proceed with your presentation.
Okay, so slide 25, to summarize the LNG market segment. The LNG market is obviously characterized by capital-intensive projects and long-term contracts. All LNG projects are extremely expensive. The LNG market is illiquid with very few players, which is in sharp contrast to the oil market, which is very transparent and highly liquid. LNG demand is expected to grow quickly over the short and long term, but supply sources are also developing. And currently, the Alaska LNG project appears to be out of the money within the global LNG supply curve, under the status quo situation that Deepa will get into shortly. However, cost and or fiscal modifications could enhance the overall competitiveness of Alaska's LNG project. Okay, so moving on, slide 26, we'll quickly run through the supply chain elements. In this section, what we did in this study was to provide to the state an overview of the current capital cost estimates for the Alaska project. We did a quick review of the capital structures that are likely to apply to the Alaska project by providing some comparative projects for them to consider. And then we undertook an assessment of the commercial structures that might be applicable to the project as well. So slide 27. What we were asked to do under slide 27 was to take a look at the expected cost for the project and see how they compare to an initial estimate that had been developed back in 2008. The 2008 estimate was developed during the AGEA process. And what we did is we worked with the state's technical consultants, Pingo International and Westlake Consulting, to assess the current status of the project. Pingo and Westlake have been working closely with the producers. And collectively, we came up with a current estimate of about $45 billion. The producers' range for the GTP pipeline and LNG project is in the $37 to $54 billion range, and I think that's the number that they've been publicly stating. Deepa mentioned earlier that there's a $45 to $65 billion range, but that also includes upstream costs that we haven't included in our assessment. Point Thompson, typically, not reserve costs, but costs around Point Thompson. So what's happened in the past 5 years that have driven these cost escalations, I suspect you're asking. A closer look reveals that the primary drivers have been modifications to the original scope, and then cost escalation that we've seen in labor and materials. Recall that in 2008, the AGEA project was focused on building a pipeline to Canada, and an LNG project wasn't the primary focus of that effort. So in 2008, the project scope was not as clearly defined as it is today. What we've seen from the GTP perspective, its costs have escalated from about $5 billion to $10 billion. This has primarily been driven by a scope change, as the project is much larger in scope now than it was back in 2008. The labor costs associated with the plant construction and owner costs have increased significantly over time. And going forward, we expect that there's going to be continued uncertainty around the scope, the complexity of the project, and the cost of the skilled labor that's going to be necessary to construct the project. The pipeline estimated costs have increased by about 50% to $12 billion. Like the GTP plant, there has also been a scope change for the pipeline. Initially, it was scoped as a lower pressure 48-inch line. Now it's scoped as a much higher pressure 42-inch pipeline with a significant amount of additional compression than what we had initially estimated. The costs, in addition to the scope change, have been due to an increase in material costs that we've seen globally over the last 5 years and a material increase in labor costs. Going forward, we expect the uncertainties around labor and material costs could increase the overall cost of the pipeline as well. And for the LNG plant, the costs have also risen significantly from 2008 to 2013. Liquefaction costs have risen globally over that period of time and now range in the neighborhood of $1,200 million per installed ton to over, $1,200 per ton of LNG to $2,500 per ton of LNG. Our estimate here was about $1,350 per ton. And given the challenges of developing a project in Alaska, specifically with respect to labor shortages, material requirements, and the logistics, we expect the costs will be under continued pressure going forward. Slide 28. Gives a brief summary of some of the capital structures to show you how they vary from project to project, and they're depending on the risk profile and the partner preferences. This slide depicts capital structures of a few projects, and each one you'll notice includes a partner in the Alaska LNG project. Most LNG projects have some level of project finance, although there are certainly exceptions to this. And in order for the project finance for the projects of this magnitude, the long-term sales and purchase agreements with creditworthy counterparties are essential to secure the financing. In the case of the Alaska LNG project and this study, we've assumed a debt equity ratio of 70% debt, 30% equity in the project pro forma that Deepa will discuss shortly. Just kind of running through these projects very quickly, the PG LNG project is located in Papua New Guinea, currently under construction, scheduled to commence operations later this year. The project's led by ExxonMobil, has a 70-30 debt equity capital structure. There are some Japanese partners participating in the project as equity participants, which has enabled this project to secure low-cost JBIC financing. The consortium, the PG LNG consortium, is responsible for marketing the LNG from the project, and long-term SPAs have been entered into with Sinopec, Osaka Gas, Tokyo Electric Power, and CPC out of Taiwan. The Australia Pacific LNG is a fully integrated project in which ConocoPhillips plays a lead role in the development of the LNG plant. Project's also under construction, and first LNG is expected in 2015. AP LNG has a 70-30 debt equity capital structure. This project, Sinopec, is a minor partner, but they're also the major off-taker of the LNG, accounting for some 85% of the LNG that's produced from the project. They've also entered into a contract with Kansai Electric in Japan. These contracts have provided the assurances necessary to the banks, so they were able to secure the project financing. Gorgon LNG, which is a project I mentioned earlier, is a 100% equity finance project. The financing is provided for from the balance sheets of the partners. You notice the primary partners, Chevron, Shell, and ExxonMobil, all have significant balance sheets. Gorgon is currently the world's largest integrated LNG project and is expected to cost in excess of $53 billion. Currently under construction, first LNG is expected in 2015. Each partner has retained their own equity lifting rights, so each partner will be responsible for selling LNG from their respective portfolios. Several SPAs have been entered into already by the partners. Good point, Deepa. She points out that this project is probably the most similar to that project that has been proposed by the producers for Alaska. The producers' preference is equity lifting rights, and in an ideal world to the producers, they would like to finance this 100% equity as well. Moving on to slide 29. Slide 29 gives you a depiction of the various commercial structures that are available to the state of Alaska and most LNG projects in that manner. There's three typical projects that are looked at: an integrated project, a merchant project, and a tolling project. In an integrated project, we have aligned risk. There's cost and risk sharing throughout, and the control is concentrated amongst the partners. In a merchant model, there's less capital requirement for the individual sponsors. Because typically what happens in a merchant project is the upstream portion and the LNG project are separated. So the producers involved in the upstream segment of the project don't have to take the capital risk of the LNG project. Excuse me. The third model, business model, is a tolling model, which has contractually assured fees and returns to the party that is operating the tolls. A tolling facility can accommodate supply from multiple upstream sources, isn't necessarily project-specific or resource-specific. And typically, there's no market upside for the LNG project in and of itself. Each structure affects operations and financing costs of the GTP pipeline and the LNG plant, and it impacts key criteria that's important to the state. Those being open access, expandability, and transparency across the entire supply chain. On slide 30, we get into some of the details that shows that each structure has advantages and disadvantages. Integrated structure allows equity partners to sell LNG under a joint venture marketing agreement or under equity lifting rights, wherein each partner is responsible for the sale of their equity share. The structure also aligns the interests of all the partners and allows for cost sharing and the sharing of any potential tax benefits that may arise. Downside to the integrated structure is capital costs are high throughout the value chain or the supply chain, as equity is shared in each link typically from the production source through the LNG plant. The concentrated control, however, makes expansions and access to third parties very difficult, as the interests of the partners may not be aligned when the talk turns to expansion. A merchant structure can lower the capital cost requirements if, for example, the producers in the upstream segment choose not to participate in the LNG project, which would result in the upstream participants having less control over the liquefaction facilities and the resulting sales and purchase agreements for the sale of LNG. From an equity participant viewpoint, however, the merchant model provides them less flexibility in terms of their ability to sell LNG volumes, as the LNG project company is the responsible party for LNG sales, thereby placing the commodity price exposure and the possible upside into the LNG project company and out of the hands of the upstream participants. The LNG project, which is typically the liquefaction terminal, would purchase the gas under this structure from the upstream producers, liquefy it, and then sell it themselves either at the tailgate of the terminal or on a next ship basis to the LNG buyers. The tolling structure provides for assured fees and returns to the service contractor. It allows for supplies from multiple sources accessed through the terminal facilities. This structure lowers the capital requirements for the upstream project sponsors, and it can facilitate the project financing as the project is not exposed to commodity price risk, but rather has a secure stream of revenue from the parties who are tolling the gas through the facilities. The major drawback of this structure is there's no upside to commodity price escalation for the service provider, as the party paying for the toll does not realize this benefit. I'll now turn the presentation back over to Deepa, who will discuss the importance of the commercial structure with respect to the alignment of interests between the state and the producers, and then the fiscal framework analysis undertaken in the study. Deepa.
Thank you, Peter. For the record, Deepa Podaval, Black and Beach. Picking up on slide 31, through the chair, Senator French, this is the example that I was referencing. We would get to, later in the presentation, where we talk about how the risk of misalignment could play out and result in lower revenues for the state. Essentially, having an integrated project with the producers controlling the upstream as well as the midstream could create a closed black box that could place risk on the expected revenues that the state could earn from this project. There could be incentives for the producers to shift revenues between the upstream and midstream segments as a way of increasing their take, thus directly or indirectly impacting what the state's take would be from the project. As an example here, we're looking at a scenario where the LNG plant service rates are established using an equity-rich financing structure and assuming a relatively high return on equity as well. Again, this is looking like it would be an integrated project, and one that may not be project finance. Any financing on a company's balance sheet may not be transparent related to this project, and so the actual capital structure as well as the cost of that financing. And the equity that's claimed by the company could be an area where there's misalignment and potential dispute. On slide 32, we demonstrate the example, and what we're looking at, two sets of charts. The one on the left examines the tariff that could potentially be set for the Alaska LNG project through the GTP pipe as well as LNG plant. And on the right, the chart looks at what the corresponding state revenues would be in each of those scenarios. We look at three scenarios. The leftmost bar is what we're describing as the reference case, and it assumes a capital structure that's representative of 70% debt and 30% equity, similar to a lot of the projects that Peter reviewed with us here a couple of slides ago. Assuming a 12% ROE, that would result in a tariff on the LNG plant of a little over $6.70. As we move to the other two scenarios that we've looked at, the middle scenario is an extreme one where we're assuming the cap structure is 100% equity, and a 14% return on equity at that, and immediately you can see how dramatically that could impact the tariff that's claimed as a deduction for the purpose of calculating netback on the LNG plant. It's close to $11 here. And then the third scenario we're looking at is one where it's a little bit more moderated with a 30% debt, 70% equity assumption, still using the 14% ROE. And so the point here is that the assumption on capital structure as well as return on equity, which is the example used here, can have a significant impact on what the netback price would be for the natural gas itself and impact the state's revenues. The chart on the right shows what the equivalent state revenue impacts would be, where the state could see its cash flows drop from $150 billion in the first scenario, which is our reference case, down to close to being $110 or $125 billion, a significant loss of value for the state if this unfavorable scenario does play out. There are some potential safeguards that regulations can provide in guidelines on how the tariff would be set and what acceptable capital structures would be and how they could be benchmarked. But that still wouldn't solve for us the potential for misalignment, including the state's need for transparency, having open access, low tariffs, being able to facilitate other third parties to explore and develop the North Slope and be able to monetize that gas. Transparency within a producer-owned project into the cost as well as cost allocation is likely to be an ongoing challenge for the state. And, I think the state has experienced some of those challenges with the TAPS pipeline as an example. And so creating alignment between the state and the producers is critical for the state to receive the value, the full value for the Alaska LNG project and create a path to have access to information.
Deepa, pause for one moment. Senator French, did you have your hand up?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question, Deepa, is about the words on page 31 about the shifting of revenues between upstream and midstream. And how that relates to the charts I'm seeing on page 32. Page 32 seems to be just a series of bar graphs depicting different financing options and the effect on mainly on the LNG tariff. But I must be missing something because you're talking about shifting revenues. Can you just lay that out maybe a little more simply for me?
Sure. Senator French, through the chair, one example we might see a value shift from the upstream to midstream could be if the project is financed not just for the GTP pipeline and the LNG plant separately, but if you had capital costs associated with Point Thompson thrown in the mix. It would be difficult to wade through that web of information to understand what could be associated with upstream financing versus midstream and downstream financing. And so some of the potential risk from the capital structure that the example shows on 32 might be realized, including the upstream as well.
Can I offer maybe a specific example of something that might pertain to this? Because it's been brought to my attention that there's some discussion about the construction of a pipeline from Point Thompson to Prudhoe Bay to help transport gas into the system, and it sounds like it might make a big difference on whether that capital cost for the pipeline was included in the midstream element or the upstream element as to how it affects our return. Is that right?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, that is correct, and we'll make a note here to create an example that would demonstrate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. It's one of the advantages, I think, of looking at the slide is, just to be clear for the public, on the left you have the project tariff that Senator French was representing correctly, and on the right are actually the state of Alaska cash flows. And the colors break out: blue is royalty, green is production tax, the gray is corporate income tax, and the yellow is property tax. And what you see is, as the financing shift correspondingly, you see, for example, the reference case, $38.6 billion in royalty, dropping in the 100% equity, 14% ROE for the LNG plant down to $24 billion. And so that's actually the quantifiable impact going on between the increase in the cost and the effect on the upstream. So the value is moving and coming at the reduction in the state revenues. And I think it's important to, again, take a step back and remind the committee members and members of the public that this isn't an analysis of the project going forward. This is an analysis of what issues and risk the state was looking at going into the heads of agreement discussion and the memorandum of understanding and the drafting of Senate Bill 138, that these were analysis that we looked at day in and day out, saying these are concerns, these are risks, these are issues to watch out for. And as we get back into a discussion about those further in the week, we'll show you ways that we attempted to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Pawlowski. Deepa, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 33, we summarize the section on supply chain elements that Peter walked through. The capital costs for the Alaska LNG project are likely to remain uncertain, and if the trends that we have seen recently with large projects, as well as that we've seen just in the estimate for the Alaska project to date, are an indication, you know, this will continue to be a significant uncertainty for this project. The total midstream project cost estimates currently range between $37 and $54 billion. We're working with a reference assumption of about $45 billion. And typically, complex LNG projects have an integrated commercial structure because they are complex, and that structure gives the sponsors maximum control. We expect the Alaska LNG project to have an integrated structure. And within that construct, then, creating alignment between the state and the producers is challenging and very important. And as Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski referred to it, the agreements that the state has entered into has been cognizant of these risks, and we believe addressed some of them, but attempted to. Moving on to slide 34, the third main scope item that we addressed in the royalty study related to the fiscal framework and its implications for the AKLNG project. Specifically, the questions that were looked at include: what are the fiscal structures that are relevant to LNG projects worldwide, and how do they compare to the Alaska LNG project? What incentives can the state provide to help facilitate the AKLNG project? And an assessment of how Alaska can leverage its royalty ownership position, specifically looking at royalty in kind versus royalty in value.
Deepa, this is Senator Giesel. The committee time has, we're down to the last 20 minutes that we scheduled for. And I think this, well, you tell me, this seems like a pretty hefty section you're entering into. Am I reading that correctly? 20, 25 minutes seems like kind of a short time to go through it. I'm wondering if this is a good stopping point. Any thoughts?
I'll defer to either Commissioner Balash or Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski on how we should do this. We possibly could get through it in the next 20 minutes, but, Madam Chair, I guess that would depend on, you know, the questions and the pace we keep. So,
Madam Chair,
Mr. Pawlowski,
we're happy to continue.
Sure. Mr. Pawlowski?
Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, for the record. I think, Madam Chair, you've identified what is naturally a good transition, and I think that given the interest around this topic. I'd recommend that the committee take a pause, and we will be working with the committee over the next couple of days. Let's bring this one back because I think it is something that deserves fresh eyes and some ready attention.
I would agree. The other thing I would mention to the committee is that those short video vignettes are available on DNR, and you'll see this section presented as well as the next one. So let's pause here. I want to thank Peter and Deepa. Thank you so much. Our next meeting is Wednesday, February 12th, convening at 3:30, and we'll take up where we've left off on this. So committee members can look forward. We'll have Black and Veatch back again, Peter, Deepa, and Jason, so that'll be great. I do want to highlight for the committee just a couple housekeeping things here. One of the things that I'm aware of is that it's a long day. Resources at the end of the day. And so I have contacted all of your offices, and there are three weekday mornings at 8 a.m. in which you're available to meet from 8 to about 8:50. We'll be fresh. They're Thursdays, they're Tuesdays, coming back with questions from the night before, and we'll be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. So we'll take that approach just to have adequate time to look at this. Also, Monday, February 17th, being a holiday, the committee will not be meeting. So we have a meeting time that we need to kind of catch up on. So with that, are there any other further comments from the committee? Senator French.
Just a question, Madam Chair, and I guess I could ask offline, but we're just here. And I'm just wondering if Jason and Deepa and Peter are available to us for questions on off hours, and whether we can call, have conversations, what the availability of is Black and Veatch to members of the legislature.
Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator French through the chair. Happy to take that offline, talk to you about making them available and specific questions you need answered. And it's just sort of they're actually DNR consultants, so it's a little awkward for Revenue to make a promise if Commissioner Bayless wants
ahead.
To say something.
I'm sure he'd like you to agree.
But we want to be available for the committee and work with members, and just happy to work with the chair and you on how to get that done.
Thanks.
And I would ask that those questions, if you would give the answers to the whole committee, that would be really helpful.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. With that, the committee will adjourn. The time is 5:12 p.m.